This week on A to Z Running, we begin a series on Lohr and Olson's wise decisions, focusing first on what they call reality-distorting mechanisms, otherwise known as the lies we tell ourselves. We answer, also, a listener question about shoe rotations and how to navigate shoes that feel great versus shoes that feel flat. In the world of running, the World Cross Country Championships were as full of blood, sweat, and tears as cross country ought to be. We've got a recap and analysis to share. Other weekend highlights include a new college athlete's NIL deal and another high school record. And from the recent headlines, we share an article about when to begin preparing for your next marathon. All this and more on A to Z Running. Welcome back to A to Z Running, where we're helping runners thrive with information, inspiration, and coaching services. And you can learn all about those things and what it looks like and how we do it at atozrunning.com. And follow us on the places where we have the stuff, like Instagram, Spotify, and YouTube. Speaking of Spotify, if you did not know, there is an interaction feature built into Spotify. Spotify's like got it all, right? You can listen or you can watch. Yes, there's a video option within Spotify, and our podcasts are all videos as well. Not that anybody here wants to watch when Andy's not around, but as she's not around today, you might just be best to listen. In any event, that's got an interaction feature also on Spotify. And shout out to Kathy, who recently noted this, discovered the interaction feature, and is excited to have done so because, let's face it, if you want to be able to interact, you want it to be as easy as possible. And that means interacting in the places where you're already consuming the content, right? So if you've got thoughts or questions for the podcast, comments and or questions, you can post those kinds of things on Spotify as well. Or if you're watching on YouTube, that's certainly got the feature built in also. And we may just feature them on air. So before we get started today, I wanted to reflect. You know that Zach likes to do this. And since Andy's not around, Zach does it even more, which is dangerous, but musings, the random musings that I have. So I was thinking, because of my run today, when you're running, do you ever find yourself just lost in thought, only to realize quite a fair bit of time later that you're kind of stuck in a rut thinking about a very strange thing for a long period of time? Well, anyway, maybe you don't do that. Maybe that's just a Zach thing and we should probably leave it at that. But on my run today, I spent, and I'm not even exaggerating here, at least 45 minutes composing an overly elaborate joke that I can promise you I will never tell anyone for two reasons. One, because by the time I finish running, I've forgotten it, which always happens. And two, because in what world does anyone want to hear an overly elaborate joke that Zach came up with in his mind on a run? All right, so that's how I spent my run today, like a large portion of it. And I just keep thinking when these things happen, the pros and cons, right? And we've actually got an interesting article that someone shared with us that we will be commenting on some point on the podcast about this very concept. Well, in any event, I should note that it's served me advantageously a number of times in the past, notwithstanding or certainly including when I was teaching high school and I was asked to deliver a speech at one of the graduation ceremonies. And knowing that it was on my mind prior to my run, I brought my phone along with me on a run one day and was just like composing the speech in my head during the entire run and using the phone for recording voice memos. And so by the time I finished the run, I had composed the entire thing. All I need to do is just kind of organize it and make sure that it actually made sense after the fact. I did that for my brother's wedding also, and I just remembered that. I was his best man and had the very great honor to be able to support him in his wedding just recently, and as such was asked to, and to his great courage, he asked his brother to deliver his graduate, or not his graduate, his best man speech kind of situation at the reception. And I composed that one on a run as well. And then props to my gracious and loving wife, who, after I got done with the run and I had this grandiose vision of this best man speech, she said, you need to do some things with that. And I did. And it was much better having gone through the gauntlet of appropriate and proper criticism. All right. So that being the case, that's a fun thing that happens sometimes on runs. And it's especially fun when you're with other people and you kind of do that together. You feed off each other's random musings, and it becomes this kind of quaint philosophical exchange or something like that. I don't know. But I think that that's interesting. Now, with that thought behind us, let's get on to your questions. Always remember that we want to interact with you more than anything else through A to Z Running. And the best kinds of things that we have to talk about on air are the things that are on your mind. So ask questions, and ask as many as you want, as often as you want. And many of you take that to heart, by the way, and I'm glad for it. We can't always feature every single question that's asked. And especially if you say, well, I've got four questions here. We're not going to put all four of them on the podcast all at once necessarily, but we'll still share thoughts as we are able. This question, and by the way, you can ask them by going to an email address. You just send your questions via email. The email address is questions@atozrunning.com. questions@atozrunning.com. So this one from Grace, great question, because it's been becoming a more and more important thing for us to be thinking about as runners in the modern era of shoe technology. It's a shoe question. Grace asked, I used to have a pretty good shoe rotation, various amounts of cushion, different brands, so different like design structures. Great. Okay, until I stumbled upon a shoe that made me feel so much better when I run. She emphasized the word so, for good reason. Now I struggle to want to run in anything else. And she does mention, and I'll share, the specific shoe is the Saucony Endorphin Speed, and that's relevant here. If you're familiar with the Saucony series, the Endorphin series has a multi-tiered dynamic. The Speed, the Endorphin Pro, there might be one other one that I always forget about, and then the Endorphin Elite. And that's, I'll explain that in a moment. Even after 400 miles on a pair of shoes, they still feel light and poppy and better than anything else in my closet. That's good. That's a lot of mileage that you can put on a shoe without feeling the degradation. As I'm recovering from a stubborn foot injury, I know that rotating shoes can provide great benefits for foot health, but I find myself putting on a different shoe, Asics, Ultras, you know, brands, irrelevant in this case, multiple different options, and going out to start the run, but circling back home to swap back out to my favorites because the other pairs feel too flat and unresponsive, making running far less enjoyable. So then the question, have you ever had this experience where you just can't part from the favorite? Have you found a way to keep a rotation with enough variety to reap the end goal benefit? Should I just suck it up and run in a flat feeling shoe, knowing that it's better for my foot health, or perhaps try to find equally poppy shoe in a different brand? Okay, so first, Grace, I appreciate the question. You're making two assumptions here, and I'm glad for your perspective as you're making these assumptions, because it helps us speak to the nature of the situation. Assumption number one is that rotating shoes is a good thing. And assumption number two is that not rotating shoes might not be as valuable to foot health, long-term, at least, is what I'm detecting here. Okay, so here's why Grace is saying that and why I would agree ultimately. When we get our feet stuck in a particular model mode, when we get our feet stuck in that sense, it tends to be an inhibiting factor to foot strength and coordination, stability, because the shoes obviously have particular nuances and they're doing certain things. So then the other problem here is that you get stuck in a certain particularity, and then when they update shoes and they don't have that particularity anymore, it tends to be difficult on our legs to adapt to the next thing. Also, very few of us race in the same shoe we train in all the time. I know many do much of the time, but you're going to put on a different shoe at some time. That matters. And different shoes are attempting to do different kinds of things for your feet. You know, a neutral cushion shoe is trying to do as little of the extra work as possible, but just make the platform soft. And then you have things like more aggressive shoes that are intending to be energizing, that are intending to be propulsory, is that a word? Propel you in some capacity, all those kinds of things, right? There's lots of motivations behind the reason a shoe is designed the way it is. Okay, so as it were, this debate is as old as modern running technology. It's been going on since at least the 70s when Bowerman started hand making his track spikes. If any of you are familiar with that, the old waffle spikes, they're called the waffle spikes because when he first made them, he literally used a waffle iron for one of the steps. Okay, so people have been constantly saying, you know, is it better for us to run with as little between us and the ground as possible? And then you have the naturalists and the barefoot running crew. The other side of it is, it is better for us to maximize recovery and performance so that we can train like aerobically at a much higher level. You've heard the talk about this lately with the super shoes, as we shared perspectives from a number of coaches that had spoken into the topic about a year ago now, where they said our athletes are now training at a higher percent of the time at a higher percent of maximum effort. And they likened it to cycling. Cyclists can train a very substantial portion of their training is near maximum effort or nearer than runners, because our limiting factor is not our energy systems. Our limiting factor is our musculoskeletal system. We break too easily if we do too much. So there's a question around that, which we have other reasons for addressing that. But anyway, I'm speaking around the edges just a little bit too much now with context. The question here then is, how much work should I be asking my feet to do versus how much should I be supporting my feet or scaffolding the work that they do? Our perspective fundamentally is one of balance. We are not on either extreme in this conversation. We certainly think that the barefoot running side of things has some interesting value in certain kinds of contexts, but has very limited practical application and ought to be very carefully addressed at most. But really, too, we don't think that people should be training in super shoes much at all. Limited capacities. And so we'll talk about that at times. But let's talk about your situation now, Grace. So we take the balanced approach, short-term, long-term thinking, and we'll keep that in mind now as we address this. So you like the shoes, your Saucony Endorphin Speeds, because they make you feel poppy, light, quick, things like that. And that's by design. The shoe is made to do that. The shoe makes your foot and ankle do less work, and it returns more energy with each stride than a standard cushion shoe. Okay? That's why you feel that way. So it's not because of a particular nuance of the shoe. It's the design intent. So yes, you can find shoes like that in every brand. And most of the time, what you're going to look for to find a shoe like that is a shoe with a nylon or a carbon plate and some kind of energizing super foam. There's a lot of different kinds of that super foam. And some are better and some are worse, but the point is all of them accomplish that to some degree. So that's why you're feeling that way. That also means that because the shoe is making you feel that way, it is clearly asking less of your musculoskeletal system. So then when you go to a shoe that isn't doing that, that isn't the purpose of the shoe, it asks more of your musculoskeletal system, which is why it feels flat and unresponsive, because it is flatter and less responsive. So then the question, which you are already posing, the question is, well, is it okay to just ask less of my feet when I'm running and train in a shoe that asks less of my feet? And this is where the short-term, long-term balanced approach comes into play. Because in the short term, you're rehabilitating a foot injury, and it's a stubborn one. So you have to be very careful right now to do nothing that aggravates the foot injury. As little as possible to set you backwards in any capacity. So if that means training more in a shoe like that because it feels better, if it feels better fundamentally, you know, it's not the same thing as if it feels better particular to that injury. You know, when you train in the other shoes, you just feel flat in general, or does it feel like it's aggravating your injury? Those are two different things. I don't care about flat feeling in general. I care about aggravating the injury, because the flat feeling in general can be addressed in other ways. So that's where then the short term is don't risk the injury, but the long term is if your feet feel flat in a regular cushion neutral shoe, you need to work on that. You need to work on that in two capacities. One is we feel like almost all strengthening, fundamental strengthening, should begin outside of the run. So start not by switching all of your shoes to flat feeling shoes that you feel miserable in. Start by doubling down on the strength and mobility work that it takes to have a precise, responsive stride without the help of shoes doing that. And so that looks like, you know, certainly working on foot and ankle strength, working on the plyometric side of foot and ankle strength as well. So this, I was running with a friend years ago now, but we've talked about it a few other times too, but we were running together. It's been the first time in a while that we ran together, and he comments, he's like, "You're really like energetic and jumpy when you're like," I bounced over a rock because there was, you know, a big boulder in our way, and jumped off the road for a second because there was, you know, like a car coming or something like that. I don't know exactly what it was, but it was straightforward stuff. But the reality was, in contrast between the two of us at the time, you could say that his running was a little bit more of a heavy plod, where I was a little bit less so. And it was not major. It was not at all some kind of major different thing. But he noticed, being himself an astute running coach also. And so he made the comment. And I thought to myself, well, a core rationale here, the fundamental thing is that's by design in terms of the nature of the kind of stuff that we do, the strength and mobility work that creates reinforces the function of the spring motion in our legs, feet, ankle, knee, hips. That should be natural. That should not be only artificially induced by the shoe. And so then when you put on the shoe that artificially enhances that, it should just be that much better. So the norm should not be the endorphin speeds, the stocking endorphin speeds. That shoe has a degree of the super foam as well as a nylon plate in the shoe. The Saucony Pro has the carbon plate. And the carbon plate is much stiffer than a nylon plate, so it gives you even more of an energy return factor. It's also worse for running slow in as a result. The faster you run, the more that has some kind of effect. The slower you run, the more that stiffness actually can be deleterious, if that's the right word. And so what you're looking for here, Grace, is in your current situation, you need to make sure that you are, if you notice that you feel flat and unresponsive in a pair of shoes that's otherwise just a normal pair of shoes, that is a negative information. That is negative information about your current state of strength and mobility. Now, it's also just, you know, an expectation bias situation, mismatch theory concept here, because you go for a run in those endorphin speeds a lot and you just kind of start to feel normal in them and you expect to feel that way. And then you run in another shoe and it's like, oh, I don't feel that way. The example is if you go run a 10K race and warm up in like a really basic neutral cushion shoe, nothing special, and then race in a super shoe and then cool down. Okay. So the warm up, you probably felt normal. The race, you just feel wonderful, right, in that shoe. And then you go jog again after the race, put back on your normal shoe, and you're going to feel like, wow, this shoe is terrible. Maybe I need a new pair of shoes right now. Maybe the shoe is just way too worn down. It has nothing to do with the shoe. It's the contrast between what you felt like with the other shoe versus this one. So that you're getting some of that right now. And you don't know for sure how much of it is you have a need in strength and mobility work that you need to reinforce and double down on, or is it just an expectation, a confirmation bias kind of situation, which has a lot to do with our main topic today. So we'll talk about that. But I would suggest that you double down on the strength and mobility side of things. You're going to ease back into a rotation of shoes for sure, because you do not want to spend all your time in the endorphin speeds because of the nature of what kind of shoe that is. There's a lot of negative connotations with spending too much time in the super shoes. It apparently is causing a number of problems, chronic issues that have otherwise been unforeseen. But even if it weren't, it would still be not a good idea to spend that much time in a shoe that is designed to be that aggressive in terms of energy return and otherwise. They are literally called the endorphin speed because that's the purpose of the shoe. So I would suggest that you move toward that rotation, but do so gradually and make sure that you're not risking the foot injury situation here. And if that means, you know, just really easing back into another pair of shoes, if that means start with doubling down on the strength and mobility and don't worry about the shoes for 2 to 4 weeks and just see how your foot's, you know, is progressing to make sure that that injury is not still hanging on. And then you can start easing back in. Certainly that. Okay, there you go. There you go. There are other situations. This is Grace's, and we're advising Grace accordingly based on what we know here. But it is definitely the case that there are other situations that call for different suggestions here, depending on what you got. Thank you for asking, Grace. Much appreciated. Hope this is helpful to you. Of course, it's helpful to you. Now, with that, let's get on to something else helpful in our main topic. We are going to address a fascinating topic for the next few weeks. We're going to do a short series on this because big ideas tend to be better when they're ingested in chunks. And so we have found that we like to do that with content. We've been spending a fair bit of time talking about needing to make better choices as runners. I think ultimately that's like the crux of A to Z running is how do we do better? What do we need to do better or something like that? I don't know. But if that's the case, we figure it's probably helpful to also look at some of the work out there on how to go about making better choices. Not what choices. We do a lot of the what choices stuff. But how do we make sure we do that well in terms of those decisions, the decision-making process, right? So we found this book, stumbled upon it really, and I wanted to be able to share some of the insights here because it's helpful. I think it's valuable to the topic. This is a work by Drs. Jim Lohr and Sheila Olson, and it is called Wise Decisions, a Science-Based Approach to Making Better Choices. And in particular, this one caught my eye for two reasons. First, because they make the bold claim in the title, Wise Decisions. Wisdom is a bold claim for two reasons. One, because by the very nature of the thing, to claim I have wisdom is to be foolish. And yes, that is true. Now, that's not to suggest that a person cannot claim to have wisdom and be correct. But by its very nature, in concept, wisdom involves a degree of necessary humility. I would say by definitionally, wisdom requires a degree of humility, or it is not necessarily what it claims to be. So it's always a bold claim. We've gone back and forth here at A to Z Running about whether we use the word wise at times. We talk about like wise training as opposed to smart training. You know, it's not about training smarter, it's about training wiser. But then we say, well, are we the ones to say what's wise and not? I think it's an important reflection. Always, before I ever claim the mantle of wisdom, to reflect heavily on what I'm saying. It's a bold claim. So that always attracts me because, first of all, then how do people go about making that claim when they do so is always interesting. I wanted to look at that. And then also there's that clickbait cliche of saying science-based. Anytime someone says, it's science-based, which is basically like saying it's a thing that's real in our opinions. And so you can see this isn't just our ideas, it's science. As it were, this may just be cynical Zach trying to find out just what they mean by that and whether I agree. But who cares if I agree? The question right now is not whether Zach agrees with your science-based claim or whether I also see your wisdom as wise, but rather what can we glean from a work like this that makes such claims such as they are. That was what attracted me to the work. Now, what I'm going to share with you about it in the coming weeks, and when Andy rejoins us, we'll be doing this together, we're going to share with you some of our key takeaways in terms of what they have to say about decision making and how we apply that when we start talking about the kinds of decisions we need to make as we so often do. So, very practical, very applicable, and at the same time, also fairly challenging, like in a personal challenge kind of sense. Oh, by the way, I'm also going to end this segment with a challenge, or I guess you could say some homework for everyone if you would like to participate to help set up the next episode in the series. Okay, let's talk about the two basic premises that the authors are making. There's more than they are taking. There's more than just this, but these are the kind of the basic ones insofar as we can base our thinking on for the rest of this time. Number one, making decisions takes energy. It's not just a thing that can just happen infinitely. It actually costs us something to decide. We know that at an instinctual level. When someone says, what do you want for lunch? And it's like, oh, I gotta think about that. I have to decide. What's your favorite color? You're making me decide something. Why do I have to choose? Why can't it just be what it's going to be? I don't know. Anyway, so that's the thing, right? It takes energy. But what the authors claim, and I think this is an important observation, not only does the decision take energy, but then the follow through with the decision takes even more energy. So we can make a lot of great decisions in our lives and do a lot of not great things after having made, and that's in large part because of this reality. So decisions take energy and follow through even more. And then the second premise, that's all one. The second premise is that we're generally bad at making good decisions. Let's just call it what it is. Humanity, humans, we're bad at making good decisions. We're really good at making bad decisions. We do it a lot. We actually just do it all the time. But good ones are a little bit tougher for us. So if you don't agree with me on that, I don't know. I don't have much else to say on the topic. No, I'm kidding. But it's true. So let's go to the authors here because it's good stuff. I'm going to occasionally read a few things from the book because I think that that's just a good way to do it. And this one in particular kind of helps set the stage for, yes, I have the book in hand with my sticky notes all over the pages even because that's what I do. Now, the authors claim, because so much is riding on the decisions we make throughout life, putting the decision-making process under a microscope with the intent of better understanding how wise decisions are made represents the central focus of this book. So in their own words, what is this book about? That. Putting the decision-making process under a microscope with the intent of better understanding how to do it. Okay, so if that's what the book is about, we need to start with why are we so bad at this? I feel like that's the most important place to start because shouldn't this just kind of be something we can do naturally? We should be able to. And the authors argue that actually naturally left to our own, we're not going to be able to do this well. And that's part of the reason why we're so bad at making good decisions as humans. So certainly the energy piece, right? That's a big piece of it because we have to make so many decisions and we run out of energy. And so whether or not we are good at making good decisions, which I'm not even trying to evaluate what that exactly means or whether that's exactly true, but just simply the existential concept of making good choices, whether or not we do that well and deliberately, it still costs energy. And the authors write a fair bit about decision fatigue and how we have to make too many decisions and then we end up just not even wanting to face the decisions. You know, a lot of it is just choice overload, as the authors say. Some poor decisions can be traced specifically to choice overload, too many options. Okay, so what else though? Because that's not the only, because we also make bad decisions when that's not the case. So what else is going on here? Good decision. This is kind of that overload thing. A good decision requires us to hold more things in our heads at once. And this is why it's so costly to make a good decision versus to just let the first thing happen that happens. Those things that we have to hold in our head include future interest, like what's good for me down the road and what do I want or aspire toward? Current wisdom and values, like what's important to me and what do I hold dear and what is good in the moment, as well as past experience and a number of things associated with that, personal and historical and societal and otherwise. So if that's the case, and this is just me kind of rambling, Zach isn't rambling, I might be. I'm riffing on the point, which is it's so costly to us because it really truly sounds like any good decision is a fairly daunting task. We can make good decisions without all of these things. It's very much possible. But to ensure good decisions more reliably, consistently, we have to be thinking in this way. And this is not fun. It's an unfun way to live. And it also is costly, as we said. So that's one side of it. But there's more to be said about this. Think about, like, on the running side of things within this costly concept. And we were talking about energy being limited just recently. Energy is a finite resource. So if decisions cost energy and we don't have that much energy in terms of limitations, more likely we're going to make bad ones. But think about running for a second, achieving a goal at all costs, right? This idea of, like, it's an avant-garde, it's a gritty thing, the all-in approach, it's very attractive. But if we weigh that perspective against the other, like, important things in life, it kind of, like, throws a wet blanket on this avant-garde, like, I'm all in, I'm gonna do it, I'm gonna wake up super early, and then I'm gonna grind all the way through the struggles and the trials and the tribulations, and yeah, I'm a little bit sore, but I'm pushing through. And what's the like, you know, the pain thing? What I'm trying to say is, it's like, you know, embrace the pain kind of mentality, and all that, like, feels gritty and cool, but probably is not wise much of the time. So there's that. We'll come back to that. And also, in that same sense, we're also very rarely operating with all of the information we ought to have in terms of, like, all of those things we should be holding in our minds at once. You know, what are the best practices? My unique physiology? Am I aware of my own strengths and weaknesses, my own limitations, all of that kind of stuff, and how to navigate that within any of these decisions about our running, about our training, about our goals, and or today's run and what I should do with that. So there's a lot to say there, and we're going to connect the dots there as well in just a moment. Now, from the authors, the other main reason, and probably the more main reason they focus on, is our brains. Specifically, the idea here being, this is my words, not the authors, that the mind is slave to the will. And so our brains, our minds, are going to do the thing that our desires want to produce. They're going to tend that way. And so what the authors suggest is, and I'll read the quote directly, our brains are always working to get us what we want in life and can deploy a surprising number of ingenious reality-distorting strategies to do just that. That is huge. That is a very important thing for us to... So this is not a dismissal of responsibility, by the way, but the idea that when I'm making these poor decisions, much of the reason is because I want a thing and my mind wants to help me get there with as little issue as possible on the way. And so it's not a deliberate, I'm not making bad choices on purpose. So I'm not thinking that this is what I should do despite knowing better most of the time. Instead, there's a lot that goes into coloring, which I can't remember the phrase that they use, I'll get to it in a moment, coloring my decisions with things that maybe are reality distorting, as the authors claim. Compare this concept, by the way, with Steve Magnus's post not long ago. We've shared this one. It was about a year ago, I think. He wrote about his concept of training the gut, or in other words, our gut instincts can actually, like, deceive us. They can lead us astray. The idea of go with your gut is really not great wisdom fundamentally, because apply the thought that we just said, because our brains are working to get us what we want and distort reality for us in order to get there. Oh man, so to go with your gut, oh boy, we got to train our gut, as Magnus suggests. Or in this instance, let's talk about how our brains are doing that, and it can be a good cautionary tale before we get into the specifics. Okay, here we go. They wanted to share three in particular, and so I'm going to touch on these because it's just really fascinating stuff. How we lie to ourselves in three particularities. The first one, these are, by the way, like, psychological concepts, and so they use a lot of the jargon, and I'm not a huge fan of jargon because I'm not an expert psychologist, meaning, like, I haven't spent a lot of time reading all of the scholarly works on the topic and academic works on the topic. And so the jargon tends to not mean nuance-wise what it probably should to me. So instead, I look at it and think, okay, so what is it specifically that they mean by that, and how can we understand it in plain English? We're going to go that route. Motivated reasoning is one of these reality-distorting mechanisms. And by definition, the authors write, non-conscious way of reasoning away contradictions that do not support the conclusions we want. So there's something here that differs from something I desire, and I can just kind of logically find a path around it. It's like I just worm my way. There's a lot of funny memes about this concept out there, and I don't know a lot of the specifics of them because Zach isn't really paying much attention to social media where these things tend to be shared, but you just see it all over the place. We can do this so well, right? The authors further state, our emotions color the facts. That's what I was intimating earlier. And give an example from tennis, actually, which I find just really funny, because I was watching recently while sitting in an airport for 12 hours, almost 12 hours. That's not an exaggeration. We were watching like the worst 10 moments in tennis in the last year or something like that. And it actually made this example come to life for me. Okay, so tennis. Players tend to see what they want to be true in reference to line judge calling. So, you know, when the ball hits the line or it's out of bounds, and players argue to no end. And it's like, who is more likely to be accurate here? The player in the heat of competition with a clear and absolute bias, or the line judge who's sitting there watching just for that thing. And yet the players fight it every single time. And then they'll go and they'll watch the video replay, because technology, we have that now. And they'll start to argue saying the technology is wrong. It's got a problem. It's not operating effectively. Look at that. The camera shook. And that means, I don't know. In track and field, they do this too. False starts. I got to tell you, false starts. It can be comical at times because it's like, you know, an athlete clearly false starts. They throw up their hands like, what are you talking about? What happened here? And then they go over and they actually show the athlete the data, because the blocks now, especially at international competition, have pressure sensors in them. So not only do they know when an athlete started versus from the camera footage, but they know when their foot pushed on the block and at what amount of time. You know, it's like thousands of a second, even more so. The level of precision is incredible. And yet the athletes will say, no, the technology is wrong. There's an error with your set. Now, I should say, grant where granting is due. There was an instance not long ago in the World Championships that they had the sensitivity of that sensor in the blocks turned way too high. And it was like the false starting at that championship was insane. It was happening constantly. And at some point, someone should have said, there could be a technology problem here, because it's not in certain individuals. It's not certain events. It's like events where false starting never happens. And so anyway, I guess the athletes arguing that have some, you got to go, there's some precedence. But in general, this is funny, is it not? That we argue to that effect. Instant replays never help anything with, you know, it's like, yeah, well, we have an instant replay. Now it's clear and definitive, except it's not. They still argue. And even then, all the fans argue too, for the same reason, because motivated reasoning, right? I have a desire. That thing doesn't fit my desire. I'm going to find a way, not consciously. This is non-conscious. It can be conscious too, but rarely ever is that. I'm going to find a way to explain away the thing. One more example. There was a recent ban of an American athlete, distance runner. And so I'm not going to give the name because I don't really want any ire from anyone for making statements one way or the other about this. But this runner was banned, and there was a whole hullabaloo about, like, it was not a legitimate ban. It wasn't intentional. She probably just was eating like regular food. Uh-oh, I'm giving it away. And all the fans of the runner had no shortage of ways to explain why this is not her fault and it was an illegitimate ban. And yet all the others were pretty clear on, like, that doesn't jive, that your crazy explanations don't really fit. Now, I don't know the full extent of the situation, and I personally actually don't have an opinion one way or the other. I always think it's a sad thing when a runner's banned, no matter what, even if they are clearly and absolutely guilty of malicious actions. Okay, so you see the point. I feel like I should do this thing because I want it. For better, for worse, doesn't matter. Remember Craig's recent question where he was asking about objective ways of measuring effort. And he's right to ask the question. Craig, I love that you asked that question because we're sitting here thinking that I desire this thing. And because I desire it, is it possible that I am not totally objective? And the answer is resoundingly yes. I am not fully objective and I cannot be insofar as I have a horse in the race. And that's what we're talking about here. Now, that doesn't mean all hope is lost and I'll never be able to make a good decision without my own motivated reasoning influencing it. That's not at all what I'm saying. But it's not going to be easy. And so let's give just a couple more here. When I tell myself that I don't want to be running today, how much more likely am I to feel badly? Okay, so I really don't want to run today. And then it's like, oh, I think my foot might actually be it. Maybe there's an injury here. Maybe there's a risk of an injury here. And I shouldn't run today. Well, is that it? Or the opposite, right? The opposite. I really want to run today. No one likes to run in 90 degrees. It's 70 degrees, sunny and clear skies for the first time in a month. If you live in West Michigan, that's a common reality. If you live in Southern California, I got nothing to say to you about your sunshine. So the point is, I really want to run today. It's so nice out. And yeah, there's this thing that this nagging problem and it kind of feels worse today. But you know what though? It's really not that bad. Actually, once I started moving around, it felt all right. It feels fine. I warmed up a little bit and I didn't hardly even notice it. So I am definitely going to run today. You see what I'm saying, right? You see the point I'm making. This motivated reasoning is contradiction is present, but I desire one thing and my mind can just make it possible, at least in my mind. The last one is weather, right? Weather always happens in this sense. Rain, cold rain especially, which was my run a number of times in the last several days. And so we can do all sorts of things. Contradiction between the bad weather and the thing maybe I'm gonna do it differently. All right, so let's talk about the next one, confirmation bias. I'm not gonna spend that much time in each one because it gets a little bit repetitive too with these kinds of things. This is the other criticism I have about psychology as an industry, which is we come up with conceptual ideas that are largely the same as another one, except with some very small difference in nuance, and we have to categorically separate them. And that is confusing. I'm not saying you shouldn't do it. I don't know. I'm not in an industry like this and really have a good understanding of why that this is done, but it's confusing. So the next one here is confirmation bias. And this one, we all understand the concept of self-fulfilling prophecy. This is a very common anomaly that I would say is common vernacular. But the definition, unknowingly biased incoming information so that it supports our pre-existing perceptions, beliefs, and desires. So this is what I already thought, which means whatever I'm getting information-wise, I taint it so that it fits what I already think. That's where you get there's a study to justify any perspective on something. So you can have a clear binary, contradictory binary in some concept. You know, super shoes are injuring runners left and right. Super shoes are increasing performance. And whichever side of that I am most aligned with, I can find information that supports it everywhere. Anecdotal, hard data, they're everywhere. And the opposite is also true. So confirmation bias in the industry of quote science is, I mean, it just, let's just be honest, you're always going to be able to prove your point somehow. Whether other people agree that you proved your point is a different thing, especially people who disagree with your original point. I see what I want to see is this. Now let's talk about an example here. I think Lydiard approaches are more reasonable than others. Personally, this is true. So I tend to view positively any sources that condone Lydiard more than ones that condemn Lydiard. And I immediately think a source is less credible if they condemn Lydiard, Arthur Lydiard and his ideas, which that's not fair, right? That's, so why are they condemning Lydiard? And the fact that they do it all should not taint my perspective of their information. Yet it does. It colors it in some capacity. Now that I am aware of that fact, but it doesn't stop from happening. So this is like expectation fulfillment. And we talk a lot about expectations here because it has so much to do with the interplay between my mind and my body and my physiology. And so that's what confirmation bias is it's expectation fulfillment. This is a thing that I expect because of my desires. And so I'm going to find a way to find that in something. So, I take to heart recommendations that support what I already want more than others that would challenge my desires. I want to run fast on long runs. So if you tell me that it's not a good idea to run fast on long runs in general right now, I probably won't listen to you because I'll find some other source that says it is a good idea and that's what I want to do. So, who knows what's going on there. You get it. Lots of things. Cognitive dissonance is number three. And this is why I said these things tend to get redundant, because cognitive dissonance is basically the same idea as motivated reasoning, except for the contradiction is outside myself. And I don't like it. I don't like contradictions. My brain does not like contradictions. And so I find a way to make it less contradictory. And this is the author's explanation. Tendency to reduce tension and psychological distress arising from incoming contradictory information. We resolve the dilemma by morphing, distorting, or altering the truth. So if there is a contradiction, this coach says running fast long runs right now is good. This coach says running fast long runs right now is not good. I don't like that contradiction. And so somehow I'm going to, morph it. Now that in that case, that's not exactly because you can prove one point or the other, and it may in fact be objectively truer one side or another side. But how about contradictory information that's a little bit less obvious? So like things like that's the do hard things and love the pain stuff, like this sense of fulfillment and accomplishment from doing hard things. That's really good, but also it's important to stay within yourself and manage your efforts well and don't train, don't strain, which is a Lydiardism. And that's also true. And so those are both true things, but they're kind of polarizing, opposing in some sense. So what do I do with that? I don't like it. I don't like that sense of like, oh, those are both true things. Struggle produces fulfillment, but also too much struggle and the wrong kind of struggle is not healthy. So we got to grapple with that. That's where the distortion comes from. What does it look like instead to filter these things through, broadly speaking, through my own specific situation, my own core values, my own needs and nuances from an objective standpoint as best as can be achieved? And that's kind of the challenge. Just a quick side note, things that we tend to be missing as the authors continue to reflect on these things. We're not objectively reflective outside of ourselves because we can't be in this state of mind. Like I don't see things from an outside perspective. I see things from within my own perspective, which is tainted by my desires. If it were possible for me to see things from an outside perspective more objectively, it'd likely be easier for me to make a good choice in that moment. Also, we're not filtering incoming and outgoing stuff, incoming information, outgoing decisions through some clear and fundamental criteria for soundness. And that's a huge, from the authors, it's like, if we don't have that objective layer, that's like, does it meet this threshold in some sense? Then our decision-making in terms of justification is all over the place. And it changes by the day and by our mood and by my the weather and things, so wow, what a an important concept for us to keep in mind here, and we're going to look at it. And the last one, just a side note similarly, is that tunnel vision is real, and we just really don't see the full picture, and could probably see more options if we looked more broadly, as it were. So here's where we're headed. I'm setting up for us now the gravity of the challenge, right? These are all things that are happening within our heads to greater and lesser degrees in different ways for different people, certainly, but it's happening. And the point fundamentally is that there is no one can make the claim in good faith or honestly that that we should trust our gut instincts and our desires are like the end all be all. That is a dishonest claim or not made in good faith, because all the evidence promotes the exact opposite fact, which is that our inner desires and our fundamental, like our gut instincts on things, are far more likely to be colored by biases that are not necessarily objectively true or serve anything outside of my own desires and purposes. So with great care, we should navigate how we interact with our desires and the world around us. That may be a loaded statement on so many levels right now, and I'm not intending to go into all the implications of those statements, but I am going to ensure that when we look at this material, we think about it in terms of those realities. So stay tuned as we address some of the key strategies that the authors are going to present. We're going to do that here in the coming couple more weeks. We're going to talk about self-coaching and our inner voice and story and how we talk to ourselves and how we improve our self-coaching. We're going to talk about managing energy, emotion, and stress and the interplay here with these ideas and more. And in order to set this up, here's your homework. I told you I was going to give you an assignment. Here is your assignment. Before you listen to the next episode, and so if you're listening to these in serially, then maybe take a few days break before the next one. 3 to 5 days at least. And if you're listening to this in real time, then before the next episode, every day, inventory your inner voice, self-talk. How am I talking to myself about the decisions I'm making? And let's keep it within the context of running, simply because it's going to be a little bit more direct in terms of our connections. But you can do that with anything you want in life in general. It's just a tall task to be trying to think about this all day long. But inventory your inner voice for the next 3 to 5 or 7 days, and just try to document, how am I talking to myself about the decisions that I'm making? How am I justifying in my head what I'm choosing to do or not do and otherwise? Okay, do that, because that's going to help you be even that much more practical as we start talking about these things next week. With that, we're ready to get on now to the world of running. In the world of running, first up, and our kind of primary focus here, is the World Cross Country Championships, which were on Saturday, March 30th, held in Serbia, by the way, in Belgrade. Unseasonably hot, it would seem. We'll talk about that. A couple things to know. First, the distance. I have been trying to figure out whether it was exact or just kind of like close. Cross country is, in a word, is raw compared to track and the roads, especially compared to track. And what I mean by that then is we don't care so much about the distance anymore. It's not really that important because, you know, how do you compare fast times? The courses are so very different that it's really incomparable. The weather is so different that it affects things even more when it's raining and course is soft and squishy, all that. So it's not really that important. But as it were, that is a lot to do with how they go about decisions for cross country. Speaking of which, the course. So if the distance is kind of who knows, the course is hilarious. And this is traditional cross country, in particular outside of the United States, what you would call like true cross country. It's a different kind of thing. So they have hazards deliberately. Like, it's not a cross-country course without hazards, so they actually make them deliberately to disrupt the runners. And so that includes things like, well, they have these pedestrian bridges in this course in particular in Belgrade, and that's out of necessity because they're crossing pedestrian crossways. But the bridges themselves are a kind of hazard because they're super steep on both sides. It's not like this gradual thing that they build up to. They just go shump, shump, up and down, more or less. And they're like really hard, and, you know, spikes on a hard surface is not lovely. So there's that. They have a deep mud section. It's just a stretch, like 10, 15, 20 feet long, of just really deep and squishy mud just to make it hard for you. And it covers the whole course. I mean, you're not going to really, a runner did in one instance at least try to go around it completely. It didn't help. She couldn't get around it because it literally covers the whole stretch there. So that's lovely. They have a classic cross-country hurdle is what they call them, which is basically just like a low hurdle. You got to jump over something because why not? And they don't have a river for you to cross in this particular instance, but that's a common phenomenon. Not a river, but, you know, like a stream. They have a hay maze, which is another common hazard for these kinds of races, where it's not actually a maze, but they put these like hay bales angled outward on both sides of the course. And so the runners have to like weave through them. It looks miserable. Or they just jump over them, which many do a little bit of both. Jump over one, weave through the next kind of thing. But it causes all sorts of problems. Traffic jam immediately as soon as you hit it. Everyone slows down and speeds up. And the person who's in front doesn't have to worry about it because they can just do whatever they want. So they just take it nice and slow through the corners. And then everyone like runs into the back of them. It's crazy. And then they just, you know, tons of really tight turns over and over and over. Really, fundamentally, the only thing that the course lacked was hills. In this particular instance, it was totally flat, minus the bridges, which I guess is why they thought, hey, let's make some artificial hills here. I don't know. But that was really something. And then the weather, I mentioned unseasonably warm, at one point hit 80 degrees during the later races, the Fahrenheit. And so that's not desirable for racing, especially if you're coming from anywhere that's not been hot lately and things like that. And so that was kind of funny. Great day for cross country is basically the word here, and a great day for the Kenyan cross country runners because they won everything except for the girls U20 race. The under 20 race for the girls was Ethiopia, but the Kenyan teams won everything else. The men's and women's races, the U20 boys race, and the mixed relay, which they have a mixed relay, which is interesting, and more on that. So let's start with the U20 races, just because these are the things you ought to know. That's just fascinating. Under 20 cross country is kind of like a bellwether for future exceptional talent. It tends to be the case that the people winning these races go on to be exceptional senior open all around athletes as well. Tend to be household names at some point in the sport. It's really something. So the girls' race in particular was a surprise because it was won by a 15-year-old Ethiopian. Now, officially, she's 15. As we know, ages are not always perfectly reported or characterized. So who knows? But the point is, she's young. And Marta Alameo, part of the situation here is being as young as she is, she has no real presence in the sport yet. So not even a profile on World Athletics page, and yet she just won the World Cross Country Championships under 20. That's impressive. So interesting to see if she is going to continue to do it. She could be like the first ever to win like five times, or four, I guess, if it's under 20. So she could be the first ever to win four times. That's never happened in World Cross Country. So anyway, we'll see. The boys race was won by a strong name in the under 20 world, but not by any means a favorite to win the race. Samuel Kibathi of Kenya, by far his best finish in a high profile event to date. So that's impressive stuff. And on the USA side, a quick note, Ellie Shea of the United States was the top talent for US girls for the second year in a row. And she's done well at this level. She certainly has done well in the United States high school scene as well. So exciting to see. And hopefully that just speaks of more good things to come. All right. She was, by the way, 15th, I believe, after finishing 10th last year. So 10th and 15th, two showings. Not bad. Next, let's talk about the mixed relay for just a moment. Weird event. So this is one of those where they do two men and two women. And being what it is, it's a cross-country course, but cross-country courses are lapped courses almost always in the international cross-country scene. So it's like a 2K-ish lap. And so each runner does one lap. So that being what makes it interesting. Also, the mixed relay side of things is always kind of fascinating. They used to have it where you could like pick which leg each of your person ran, and then they realized real fast that wasn't a great idea, because then you have sometimes women running against men, and that can be a problem for a number of reasons, like, you know, just discouraging for the athlete if you're a woman and you just suddenly get blitzed by a man. And anyway, the point is they now require the order. So it goes man, woman, man, woman for each team. And so went according to predictions. Kenya won the race, Ethiopia second, to believe. Yes, Ethiopia second. And then the bronze medal was kind of up for grabs. Who knows? I think that – so the United States has been, I believe, fourth or close to that. And shout out, though, to Adam Fogg of Great Britain. Great Britain ran its strongest legs last. Its strongest man, third leg, and its strongest woman, fourth leg. And it paid off because Adam Fogg's third leg, his rep was – very impressive. I believe they said it was the second fastest of the day or of that leg. And brought Great Britain from a pretty rough position into a decent spot. And then the closer did the same and finished well. And so the team ended up with the bronze after United States was in position for it. But, well, I guess the story, the United States ran an injured runner for their fourth leg. Now, she did say, Katie Izzo did say that she had been training and able to train well and felt like she was ready to race, but she broke her foot like 2 months ago. And that's not, a broken foot 2 months ago, that's not enough time. So I'm not exactly sure what the decision-making process there was, but that's a tough situation for her to be in. Women's race overall. Let's talk about that because this is where things got totally crazy. We already knew going into this race that Kenya was going to be a force with which to be reckoned for a number of reasons, four of them being Kenya had the individual champion last year in the likes of Beatrice Chebet, who has gone on to be a silver medalist on the track 5,000, as well as one of three women who ran faster than the previous 5,000 meter world record this past summer. She was one of those three who did so. She did not set the world record because she was second in that race, but she did run faster than the previous world record. So anyway, Beatrice Chebet, 5K road world champion as well this year. She was certainly a favorite going into the race, not the favorite, but amongst them. But the other favorites were all on the Kenyan team, which included Lillian Rangarukh, who is a very strong competitor in the international scene and has been a strong presence even in the cross-country scene now for 8 years plus, 7 years plus. And then Agnes Nagetich, who just recently broke the world record in the 10K on the roads when she ran 28:46. I have a lot of things I could say about that. I'm not going to say them all right now. We talked about that. We covered it when it happened. So Nagetich was a clear favorite to win the race. This is a 10K cross-country race, even though it's cross-country. It's not the same thing. But that fast of a time, that recent, it was in January. And then Immaculate Anyango, who Achol is her other name, you'll see depending on where it's reported. And she also ran under 29 minutes in that same 10K with Nagetich. So you can see that's four of six of the Kenyan runners who are in the race, and you only score four. And so everyone seeing the rosters here is like, there's no way the Kenyan women lose. Well, not only did they not lose, they took first through fifth places, swept one through five, which you only score four places. So they even had a bonus one in there. But not only did they finish first through fifth, but the next athlete to cross the line after Kenya's fifth runner was 33 seconds back. So they took first through fifth, and it wasn't even close. Their top five all dominated the rest of the field. That's incredible. That is quite incredible. Beatrice Chebet defended her individual title 2 years in a row, which is a very rare thing in world cross country. And many said, you know, she wasn't a shoo-in for it, as mentioned, but at the same time, she's the most decorated of the athletes here on that Kenyan squad. And so it's not surprising. Agnes Nagetich finished fifth after that impressive 10K run. And so you can see the quality of this group. Immaculate Anyango was fourth after her incredible 10K run too. So Lillian Rangarukh took silver, which is not the first time she's taken silver at the cross country champs either. So here's what you have. The only other time a better finish has happened was, I think they said in 2019 or 17, one of those two in the world cross country, Kenya took first through sixth places, which, by the way, Rengaruk was on that team as well. So aside from that, this was an incredible, outstanding thing. All right, well, there you can see now that was the race. The race was those five Kenyans together in a pack the whole time until the final 1500 meters or so. Top U.S. finisher was Wayne Kalati, who has been very strong on the scene for the United States. She won the U.S. cross country championships and has just continued to rise in the last couple of years now. Now, Kalati finished 15th, but spent the first four laps of a five lap race, 80% of the race, in the top 10 and as high as like 6th, 7th, in chasing that Kenyan squad. What's interesting to me is the way people are reporting on this. And so I have no desire to be contentious or to belittle the accomplishments that Kalati has, but her strategy was to try to go with the leaders, but they were doing things that she should not have been doing. She was like delirious by the end and barely able to stay upright and ended up in the medical tent because she just ran herself into the ground running too fast on a hot day on a very challenging kind of run with all of the hazards and such. And so everyone's calling this race brave. I do not feel like that's a brave strategy in that situation, and in contrast to the other kind of strategy, which would be to run your own race despite the risk of, you know, you don't know if what's going to happen up in front of you, but at the same time, you still make the choice to try to do your what is best and likeliest for your best finish. Who knows? Again, I'm not trying to be critical of Kalati, but rather the way people keep reporting on it is interesting to me. Now, the other side of it is that Let's Run has the headline, Kalati perseveres despite adversity. And I think to myself, there's like, she faced the exact same adversity of every single person in that race. Insofar as like, she didn't have anything uniquely adverse about her own experience versus someone else's, except that she went out too hard and shouldn't have done that. But that's, you know, hindsight, right? I'm Monday morning quarterbacking here, or whatever that phrase is. And you can always say that after the fact, but the reality is it was a tough day. And you know this because of how many people did not start and finish the race, which was many. There was also, by the way, a quick note, one missing name from the Kenyan team, which is the number two ranked cross-country runner in the world right now, who is Kenyan as well, Lucy Mawia. Why that is interesting is because she just did not run the Kenyan trials, not for injury purposes. And we just found out why. Well, she is now facing a provisional suspension from a doping bust. So there's that. But that just speaks to Kenya's depth now when you think about how many runners, world number two ranked, didn't even show up, and Kenya took first through fifth. All right. On the men's race, Jacob Kiplimo from Uganda defended his title. Let's start right with that. Very strong field. As a matter of fact, the craziness, the race went out, and it was an Indian runner who took it out really, really fast, and no one went with him initially, so he was out by himself. The announcer actually didn't even realize what was happening. The announcer thought when the camera was showing him that it was because he had started after everyone and was way behind everyone, and he was like, oh no, what a bummer, you know, what happened? And then the other announcer said, no, he's the one in first. He's like, what? Where's everybody else? Because they were only like half a mile into the race, and you couldn't even see any of the, like, you could not see any of the other runners on camera. But that they were in a section with turns, and they caught him not long after that. He just went out too fast for some reason. But Jacob Kiplimo from Uganda won last year, won again this year. This dude is a world-class talent, beating a very strong field, including another champion in cross-country, as well as a world record holder, Joshua Cheptegei, countryman from Uganda, and historical talents like Berihu Awagawi, who is a Diamond League champion and multiple time top finisher, world-class races. And then Benson Kiplangat from Kenya was the U25K champ a few years back, so he's got certainly the accolades. And it should be noted that just like in the women's race, it is very rare for a champion to repeat in world cross country, and that puts Kiplimo in the rosters of the likes of Kenenisa Bekele, Paul Turgat, both world record holders and multiple things. But Kiplimo should already be considered in that category. We should not think, oh, now he's arriving. No, the guy is already a world record holder in the half marathon, multiple discipline medalist across track, roads, and cross country. The guy is a generational talent, to be sure. So in that note, it was still Kenya as a team that just dominated everything. They put five guys in the top eight, so they didn't sweep the race like the women. As a matter of fact, their top finisher was third, but yet five in the top eight, by far the highest, the greatest depth, and just really impressive stuff. And I should just mention that the only runners who broke up that five-member squad of the Kenyans were themselves individual world-class talents. And that just really speaks to that caliber of runner that the Kenyan team brought. Jacob Kiplimo, Joshua Cheptegei, and Barry Huawaragawi were the only three who broke up the top five finishers from Kenya. And all three of them are world record holder or world champion caliber athletes. That's crazy. Crazy to think about. So there you go, World Cross Country Championships. It was just really interesting. I love watching cross country. It's way more interesting to watch cross country than any other type of running event. And yet it gets the least amount of general attention, in part because it's not as quantifiable. You can't put your finger on it precisely because the times don't really mean anything. And the courses are all just super weird and wonky. But the racing, raw. And I love it. All right. Let's talk about a weekend roundup for a minute. I'm just going to kind of go through a few quick notes from things. First, Elizabeth Leachman, which you recall, high school runner from Texas, is at it again. She set high school records in the 3,200 meters just recently, multiple times in 1 month. Now she just broke the high school 5,000 meter record and the United States U20 record in the same race, in this instance. She ran 15:25. And by the way, the previous high school record was also 15:25. She only broke it by half a second, which is really quite something. That was held by Natalie Cook, set 2 years ago. But what's even more impressive, she ran the whole thing solo. Leachman ran the whole thing solo. Well, I mean, not exactly the whole entire thing, but she won the race by 35 seconds. The next finisher is 16 minutes and set a meet record. This was a collegiate race. This is not a high school race. Just trash the collegians. It's just really kind of funny when I think that happens. I remember when I was thinking myself hot stuff and then got beat by a high schooler. And I thought, wow, that, you know, it tells you something about, it just kind of puts your perspective in place. I like it. All right. Let's not forget though about Colorado sophomore Addie Ritzenhain. Of course, a familiar name on this show. She just ran 4:44 in the 1600 meters at a mile of elevation, of altitude. And side note, it is true that altitude affects the mile run less than longer races, but it still has an effect, certainly. And a mile of altitude, yeah, that doesn't feel great. So very impressive stuff. That always speaks to what else will we see from her? We'll find out. Jasmine Paris, remember the Barkley Marathon? She's the first and only so far female finisher for Barkley Marathons. Well, in after-the-fact interviews, she has said some interesting things, and one that I just wanted to share with you here from The Guardian was, if you don't make this, what she is telling herself in the last, like, half mile, in the last mile of the race, if you don't make this, you will have to do it all over again. Because she's done it. That was her third attempt, remember? And so that's exactly right. She's like, oh, I'm going to have to keep trying if I don't do it. So do it. Good. Okay. How about over in China in the Wuxi Marathon, a new Chinese marathon record set by Jia He in 2:06:57. That's quite impressive. Good stuff. And then in the collegiate running scene, Nico Young, who we've been talking so much about him because he's just doing everything in the last few months, just doing it all, setting all the records, winning all the races. Well, he finally signed an NIL deal. I thought he had one already. I thought I had seen something about that 2 years ago, but no, he didn't. And now he's got an NIL deal with Adidas. And that's not terribly surprising to people. Adidas sponsors his college team, which of course is not a requirement for the NIL, but also Adidas is the brand that is most commonly what Mike Smith, which is NAU's coach, Nico Young's coach, but also he coaches pros, pro athletes on the side, and Adidas is the brand that he is most associated with as well for that purpose. And so, and everyone's speculating Nico Young's going pro soon, and he's probably going to keep training with Mike Smith and run with his pro support and group and stuff, and this all just speaks to future contract with Adidas, it sounds like. So we'll see. But Nico Young, perhaps the most famous and popular collegiate athlete on the scene in the last couple years, and yet only just now signed himself an NIL deal. And I bet it's a pretty sweet deal. All right. Last note here now in the headlines, as I mentioned before, we're going to now in the World of Running segment, we'll end it with just looking at the running news headlines, not just race results and stuff. And so here you go in the headlines. This was a Runner's World article published within the last week here. And I thought it was a fascinating. So it's specifically about New York City Marathon, but the takeaways are obviously more general. And it's an interesting examination. I actually like it. I have to say it. Like, you hear me talk about Runner's World, and it's like, Runner's World. But I actually like this one. I like the things they have to say and what they're sharing. So this is how to prep for the New York City Marathon starting now. NYC Marathon is November, I think, this year. Either way, it's first week, second week of November every year. And we're quite a ways out from that. But to their credit, this is a really valuable article, because most people think about a race, you know, in the fall. That's not really current thinking. But if you're running a marathon in the fall, that should influence what you're doing today. Not in the same way as if you're running a marathon in 3 months, but it should influence in some capacity. And they had some interesting thoughts to share. So the basic assumption, why? Because it takes longer than one season to prep well for a marathon. And they have a funny quote. They interviewed a few different coaches, in particular Jason Fitzgerald was one of them. He's the strength running guy, the guru. Apparently they misspelled his name in the article, unless they just interviewed a different Jason Fitz something. But anyway, I think it's the same guy. He said, there's no couch to marathon training plan. And I add, at least there shouldn't be, but he's right, because you don't, that perspective is a bad one for the marathon. And so it takes longer. We need to spend more time preparing. And just because you're building a base now doesn't mean you can't enjoy this season too. And that's also good advice. So have some kind of immediate focal point, but with the background knowledge of what I'm doing now is to build a base for the marathon later. I like it. So they talked about like prep for a 5K or something this spring. Whatever you want, but do something. That's good. They also mentioned tune-up races along the season. So if you're gearing up now, it's July, and you're starting to plan for your November marathon, do a couple other races. And don't just have that be the only thing. And especially in the last third of the training season, some capacity. Not other marathons necessarily, but other races. And then they comment about strength training, and as well they ought to if they're interviewing Jason Fitzgerald, because that is literally his shtick. Now, he has a lot of material on a lot of topics, but the strength running guy is his big thing. And they specifically say, you know, that's a really important thing for marathoners, and we tend to neglect it because we only have so much time and we spend most of it running. So good on them. And the last of note, their number 10 on their list was, don't get tied to a time goal, at least right now. Of course, you know me, I'm going to say don't get tied to a time goal ever. What's the point? Time goals are bad data, or generate bad expectations, I guess that's a better way to say that. But their point was, the other coach source they used, a coach named Caitlin Goodman out of Seattle, says she doesn't give athletes time goals until the last 1 or 2 weeks of the season, like 1 or 2 weeks before the race. That's savvy. I would say, you know, I still don't want to give an athlete a time goal even at that point. But if you're going to, that's the only time that it matters. And here's why. Because you don't know what fitness you're in until you have built the fitness. So don't set a time goal in March for a November marathon. That is absurd. Instead, your goals in March are around the things you do that make you a better runner, to build fitness and to do all that stuff. Those are what your goals should be oriented around. And you can have in the back of your mind, like, I want to qualify for Boston and stuff like that. That's great. But you don't know what you're capable of in March for a November marathon. It's just, you don't have that knowledge yet. So do the training, do the work that gets you there. And then if you have to set a time goal, wait until a few weeks before the race with now the informed decisions around your training and prep. So there you have it. That's a lot of good stuff to think about for today. And we could keep going, but we should stop there. Now, on that note, remember your homework. If you were listening to the main topic section, I said you gotta, to prep for the next installment in our current series on wise decisions, you gotta take an inventory. It's a self-talk inventory, inner voice inventory. How are you talking through your situations in your own mind? The way you're justifying your decisions, the way you're reacting to the things happening around you, okay? And in particular, about running, ideally, because that's kind of our focal point as we're addressing this, but you can do this with anything you want. So make note of these things. And the best way to do that is, you know, journal it. Journal your self-talk, maybe the end of the day or something where, you know, where you have the time opportunity. And in doing that, that's going to help you interact with the ideas we're going to be sharing in the next 2 weeks coming up. So all of that is good stuff. Get your homework done and do it on time or it's not going to help. There's no point in turning it in late because it doesn't matter anymore. So do it, and then we'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening. Talk to you again soon.